KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump has repeatedly promised to end Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and after phone calls with leaders of both countries, he says peace is on the way. Is it? More ahead on Morning Edition from NPR News. Business executive Linda McMahon could become the next Secretary of Education. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. If confirmed by the Senate, her number one job would be to dismantle the very department she'd be in charge of. Yellow Jackets is back. The series about a girls' high school soccer team who survive a plane crash in the Canadian wilderness debuts its third season. Rekindled love is a major storyline. We speak to two of the stars. It's Thursday, February 13th. English singer-songwriter Peter Gabriel is 75 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A Senate panel is holding the confirmation hearing for President Trump's nominee to be Education Secretary. Linda McMahon says she's bringing Trump's vision to the education agency.
He pledged to make American education the best in the world, return education to the states where it belongs, and free American students from the education bureaucracy through school choice. November proved that Americans overwhelmingly support the president's vision, and I am ready to enact it.
McMahon has little experience in education. She has previously served as the administrator for the Small Business Administration. The Senate is now holding the confirmation vote for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be Health and Human Services Secretary. He has already passed a Senate test vote. Democrats have strongly opposed Kennedy, citing his years of work against vaccines. President Trump says he is going to announce new reciprocal tariffs this afternoon. These taxes are supposed to match what other countries charge for U.S. goods exported to their nations. But economists warn the tariffs can also raise prices for American consumers. Trump's actions come as he gets ready to welcome India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi to the White House today. NPR's Asma Khalid reports they're expected to discuss tariffs.
President Trump has had a warm relationship with India's leader, but he's also accused India of being a, quote, big abuser of trade. Lisa Curtis served in the first Trump administration working on issues relating to India.
Trump's priorities are seeing India's high tariffs lowered on U.S. goods. That's a number one priority for him.
Other issues between the countries include immigration, technology, and defense. The U.S. relationship with India has seen strong bipartisan support in recent years, especially as a counter to China's influence in the region. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
The U.S.'s NATO allies in Europe are stressing they must not be cut out of any peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. This comes after President Trump spoke yesterday with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump also spoke by phone to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. NPR's Rob Schmitz has more.
European leaders have shown frustration after the Trump administration signaled it's planning unilateral face-to-face talks with Russia on how to end its war in Ukraine. German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius told reporters Europe must be involved in any negotiations on Ukraine, especially, he said, if Europe is to play a central role in keeping the peace. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth insisted this week Ukraine should not join NATO and that it's up to Europe to protect itself from whatever Russia might do next. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte says it's crucial that any peace deal on Ukraine endures without another Russian attack. Rob Schmitz, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas appears to be back on track after a few days of uncertainty. Hamas had said it would delay the scheduled release of three Israeli hostages that was set for Saturday. Hamas accused Israel of violating the ceasefire. Israel rejected that. It warned hostilities could resume in Gaza if the terms of the deal were not kept. Authorities in Germany say at least 28 people have been hurt after a man drove into a crowd of people attending a protest march. Officials say the driver is an asylum seeker from Afghanistan. They believe this was an attack. In the U.S., forecasters say an atmospheric river is drenching California. The intense storm will bring valuable rain. But NPR's Alejandra Barundo reports there's a bigger risk for mudslides and flooding.
Atmospheric rivers are exactly what they sound like, giant ribbons of water vapor flowing through the sky like a river.
If you look at them from a satellite, they actually look a little bit like a river, where they're sort of long and narrow and they meander.
That's atmospheric scientist Christine Shields from the National Center for Atmospheric Research. She says atmospheric rivers are a normal part of California weather and can deliver a lot of valuable water to the region. But they often include short and intense bursts of heavy rainfall that can lead to flooding. And in the burned areas around Los Angeles, potential debris flows and mudslides. That's why experts say it's important to keep close track of emergency alerts. Alejandra Burunda, NPR News.
Prices for chocolate are higher ahead of Valentine's Day. The supply of cocoa from the West African nations have been depleted because of changing climate patterns. That's forced chocolate makers to boost prices. It's NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics with I'm Still Here, a film by Walter Salles starring Fernanda Torres. A woman is forced to reinvent herself after her family suffers an injustice by the Brazilian government. Now playing only in theaters.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. In a single day, President Trump has rewritten U.S. foreign policy on Russia. Trump said yesterday he talked with Russia's President Vladimir Putin and then spoke with Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, declaring that peace talks should start immediately, beginning with meetings with Putin.
We ultimately expect to meet. In fact, we expect that he'll come here and I'll go there, and we're going to meet also probably in Saudi Arabia. The first time we'll meet in Saudi Arabia, see if we can get something done. But we want to end that war. That war is a disaster.
So is a durable peace on the horizon? To discuss, we're joined by Jeremy Shapiro. He's the research director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. Good morning, and thanks for being on the program.
Good morning.
So how significant was this call between Putin and a sitting U.S. president and Trump's promise of a meeting?
It's quite significant. Anytime the U.S. president and the Russian president talk is very important, but maybe more importantly, it's the first concrete sign that both sides are actually willing to negotiate on this war.
And what do you make of these negotiations? I mean, is this something that will be in the interest of the U.S.?
Well, it's in the interest of the U.S. as Trump has defined it. We could argue over whether that's the right definition, but he has very few things that he actually wants out of a peace settlement with Russia over Ukraine. He said it just yesterday, I'm just here to try and get peace. I don't care so much about anything. He seems to want to get the U.S. out of the war, and he can achieve those things. The Ukrainians have other goals.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth yesterday told NATO allies it's not realistic to expect NATO membership for Ukraine, which Ukraine wants, or to restore Ukrainian territory in Crimea that Russia seized in its invasion more than 10 years ago. Is the U.S. already conceding ground before talks even begin?
Yes, they are conceding ground, but it's not ground that they really wanted to hold. So I think it wasn't seen from the perspective of Trump or Hegseth as important ground that they were conceding. I guess from a Ukrainian or even a European perspective, it's a bit of a disaster.
Say more about that. I mean, right now we haven't heard from Ukrainians in this moment.
Well, Ukrainians are very concerned that any peace deal between the U.S. and Russia will leave them out in the cold. They've wanted security guarantees from the United States, optimally in the form of a NATO guarantee that will protect them in case Russia restarts the war after a settlement. What Hegseth and Trump have essentially done is rule out any future guarantee that will make Ukrainians feel like stopping the war isn't just a temporary way of allowing Russia to rest and refit and come back in a few years' time.
Some analysts and Ukrainians argue that Trump speaking with or agreeing to speak with Putin or meet with Putin legitimizes Russia's imperialistic actions and could ultimately embolden him to do more with Ukraine or elsewhere. What kind of message is Trump sending to the world by seeking peace in this way, where conceding land is a possibility?
I think he's sending a few different messages. First, he's saying that it's not the U.S.'s responsibility to protect Ukraine and Europe. Second, I think he is sending the message, not exactly that aggression can hold, but that it's possible to change borders. And of course, he's been talking about changing borders in the U.S. with Greenland and Panama and even Canada. So I think he is sending the message that the sort of global world order, which has meant that borders are inviolable, is no longer operational.
But what would an alternative look like? I mean, to get to a place where this war ends that wouldn't cede territory, which is in contravention of international law, what would a different alternative look like?
I'm not really sure that there is much of an alternative, because the military on the ground makes the difference. And Russia right now is winning this war on the ground. And unless the United States is willing to put in more effort, which Trump is not, then this is the deal that they're probably going to have to take.
Jeremy Shapiro, he's the research director of the European Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
As Ukraine pushes for continued U.S. support, President Trump is pushing for something in return: rare earth metals. These minerals are essential for smartphones, batteries, even defense technology, and Ukraine is hoping they'll get Trump to continue U.S. military and financial support. It's a high-stakes transactional shift in diplomacy. Tune in to All Things Considered later today for the full story.
Linda McMahon's Senate confirmation hearing for Education Secretary today could be dramatic and unusual.
Yeah, that's because the Trump administration has made clear that it plans to dismantle the department she's been nominated to lead.
NPR's Janaki Mehta has been following this story. Good morning, Janaki.
Good morning.
Before we get to what we can expect on the Hill today, would you just start by telling us the latest at the Education Department?
Yeah, so on Monday, Elon Musk's unit, Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, made severe cuts to the Education Department's independent research arm. I'm talking about the Institute of Education Sciences, or IES. DOGE eliminated most of the contracts the institute holds, nearly $9 million worth. And IES is responsible for collecting and sharing massive swaths of data that help shape the education system in this country, and they rely heavily on contractors to do it. Their work is on hold right now.
President Trump has made it clear that job one for McMahon will be dismantling the department. Will anything be left if she steps in to lead it?
Yeah, well, I would say first of all, the elimination of the department would require an act of Congress. But yeah, if McMahon's confirmed, her first order of business will probably be to slim the department down further. In fact, on Tuesday, President Trump said he hopes she will work herself out of a job. By the way, this is an agency that has an annual budget of $79 billion, 4,200 employees. It's one of the smallest federal agencies. And the Education Department oversees some pretty consequential programs, like one that sends money to schools in low-income communities, another to protect the civil rights of students with disabilities. So hypothetically, McMahon would be charged with overseeing these kinds of programs as long as Congress plans to keep protecting them.
So what exactly are we expecting at the confirmation hearing today?
Yeah, so I think one clue came from a House hearing on education last week. If that's any indication, the line of questioning to McMahon is probably going to be split along party lines. Here's a taste from that hearing.
The irony is not lost on me that we're here to discuss the state of American education while current administration is actively discussing how to dismantle the main federal agency responsible for ensuring safe, quality education for all students.
That's Democratic Representative Bobby Scott of Virginia. And here's Republican Representative from Missouri, Bob Onder, arguing the Biden and Education Department basically pushed liberal identity politics over learning.
I believe abolishing the Department of Education is definitely a big part of the solution. How can we get back on the focus of educating kids rather than indoctrination and, you know, bloating our school bureaucracies?
I should say, Michelle, the department doesn't actually play a role at all in shaping school curriculum. The law prevents it from doing just that.
Has McMahon shared anything about her own thoughts about where she stands on what should be done with the Department of Education?
Yeah, I'll start by saying McMahon doesn't have much of a background in education. She did serve on the Connecticut State Board of Education for a year. She's probably best known for leading WWE for decades, World Wrestling Entertainment. So she hasn't said anything in recent days about what she'd do with the department, but in December she said on X she would work on, quote, reforming the Department of Education. And we know she supports school choice, for example. We tried reaching her for an interview multiple times and we haven't heard back. So we'll wait and see how she brings those skills to this department if she's confirmed.
That is NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta. Janaki, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Nonprofit organizations are responsible for helping newly arrived refugees settle into life in the U.S. Since the Trump administration paused the program to admit refugees and froze funds that supports the work they do, they've been scrambling to provide services to over 22,000 newly arrived refugees. NPR's immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo reports.
Once a refugee gets to the United States, they are greeted by one of thousands of staff and volunteers at local and national resettlement organizations. The work they do over the person's first 90 days in the country is sprawling.
Receiving people at the airport, supporting them to find housing, enroll children in school, access healthcare, and help people find work and learn English.
That's Catherine Reberg of the Church World Service, one of the flagship organizations conducting refugee resettlement. But now she says,
it's those services that are really at risk.
Across the federal government, Trump ordered funding and work to be paused. It's not immediately clear if the funding freezes are directly tied to the administration's review of refugee programs, or they could be caused by technological errors or internal confusion. But some, like Laura Race, who worked on immigration issues for the first Trump administration, agree with the president that a review of funds is needed.
It doesn't make sense to keep sending money out the door and try to analyze it all at the same time.
Still, refugee resettlement workers fear they won't be able to support tens of thousands of refugees in their process to integrate into the U.S.
They've left us completely in the dark.
That's Caitlin Lewis, executive director of the Community Center for Immigrants in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Her organization uses grants from the Homeland Security Department to help refugees acquire green cards. Refugees are required by law to seek permanent status after 1 year of being here.
I'm in regular contact with our grant program officers. It's just a shock that it's like, wow, everything we're doing aligns with all these new executive orders, yet our funding is still frozen.
Nonprofit leaders say their mission of facilitating a legal pathway to citizenship is at risk. Meanwhile, several pages related to refugee resettlement programming across the State Department and DHS have been archived, and it's not clear when or if support from the federal government will resume. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air, filmmaker, photographer, professor, and writer Ramel Ross. He's nominated for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for the film Nickel Boys, which he also directed. The movie's also nominated for Best Picture. It's about two young black men in the 60s attempting to survive a brutal reformatory academy. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Season 3 of Yellow Jackets starts streaming tomorrow, and fans have waited nearly 2 years. So it begins with a recap as told by some of its characters. A plane transporting a high school girls' soccer team crashed in a remote wilderness.
They survived hunger. They survived blizzards.
Stranded for months, their survival became the fodder for stories that may or may not be true.
They worshipped evil spirits, and they hunted their friends, and they feasted on their flesh, and they liked it.
Yellow Jackets is unnerving, told from multiple vantage points, those of the high schoolers and those who survived into adulthood. I spoke with two of the actors playing adults. Tawny Cypress is Thaisa, and Lauren Ambrose plays Van. Their characters shared a romance in their teenage years, then they separated after returning to civilization. And as adults, they discover each other again, and that love is rekindled. But what drove them apart is never fully explained. Actually, a lot of what happened in the wilderness is yet to be explained. That's where I started with Tawny Cypress. I want to know about how much you all know about what's going on. Are you getting your scripts? Like, do you get the full season when you start?
No, sometimes we have to beg them for scripts. We're like, please, we start filming in 2 days.
So with not really knowing where it's going, how do you play the character? I mean, because you're playing these complicated people dealing with trauma you've all been through and are manifesting really differently, but you also don't know exactly what's going on either. So how do you play the character that way? Tawny, maybe we start with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's television, you right. know, it's like water. You have to be able to go with the motion of the ocean. You know the character, and then whatever gets thrown at you is really like a puzzle that you sort of fit in to this character that you've already built.
Lauren?
Yeah, you know, you just play the scene, really. That's what I've learned in all these years, is that you play the scene together, and usually if there's a mystery, the answer lies in your scene partner's eyes, and you just, we find our way together.
And you two are so incredible together and so different in how they deal with trauma. Tawny, your character is a little terrifying, in my opinion.
Thank you. She's so selfish. It's ridiculous. I can't believe it. I would hate this woman. She would definitely not be my friend.
Is it fun to play somebody that you would hate?
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, my God. Honestly, she's so narcissistic. Everything she does, even when it seems loving, it's always for her. And it's fun to be selfish like that, for sure.
Now, Lauren, Van, the character you play, really deals with her trauma very differently. And you've been estranged with Tawny's character, Thaisa, for years. And you come back together. Can you talk about that coming back together and how your character deals with trauma in a totally different way?
Yeah, I think the years have sort of worn on Van, and just a lot of pain and sadness there. There's this beautiful scene in the first season, when I wasn't yet on the show, and Thaisa and Van come to the kids throw themselves like a homecoming dance, and they're each other's date. And the rest of the soccer team receives them with joy and cheers for them. And I remember watching it and thinking, wow, like, that wouldn't necessarily happen in their high school in the 90s. But somehow out there in the wilderness, they can be this true expression of themselves, of their sexuality. And then what happened when they got back and have to leave that freedom that they found out there? And what kind of hurt that causes and what that then does to a person?
Thaisa is kind of relishing this return to the past that sort of starts, and Van is terrified of it. What draws the two characters together despite these two very different feelings about going back or looking back?
I mean, they're meant to be. They're these two women are just cosmically connected across time and space. They hold secrets and the truth for each other.
The thing that's so unique about the show is the way it balances these really dark plot lines with real humor. How do you find that balance? Let's start with you, Tani.
Oh, gosh. I don't think my character is very funny.
No.
I don't get hired for comedy, unfortunately. I would love to. I think I'm funny, but apparently I am not.
And Lauren?
I can attest that Tani is indeed very funny. Yeah, no, I think Van is a really fun character. It's been really fun, witty quips. But, you know, yeah, the show can be so dark and weird and gross. And so it's nice to have the levity of that, for sure.
Speaking of which, it drops on Valentine's Day, which, you know, nothing says love like cannibalism, cults, dark forces. What do you think of the choice to drop it on that day?
It's fitting.
Especially for our little storyline, right?
So yes, that's what I'm thinking.
There's this little love story at the heart of it.
I've never seen especially a women cast like this. Like, it makes you think of Lord of the Flies, but with women and totally different outcomes.
I've spent 25 years playing, you know, these one-dimensional women who spit two paragraphs of exposition and with zero heart behind anything. I never thought I'd get to play a character like this, and I never thought I'd get on a show with women like this. Like, it's a dream come true.
So how do you responsibly tease what's about to happen to your characters without giving away the plot line? Like, what do you want people to know?
I think me and Lauren set out to give a beautiful love story, and I hope that that comes across. And also, there's this one moment or two moments that will make people cry and throw up at the same time.
That was Tani Cypress, who plays Thaisa, and Lauren Ambrose, who plays Van, on the show Yellow Jackets, Season 3, begins Friday, Paramount Plus and Showtime. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Layla. It was cool.
This is NPR News.
The Panama Canal needs more water.
There's this scientist side saying, wow, that's really fascinating. But then the other human side says, ooh, that's really bad.
The solution? A dam that would drown entire communities. I'm Ari Shapiro, reporting from the Rio Indio in Panama on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Prime Minister of India is the latest foreign leader to visit the White House since President Trump took office a little over 3 weeks ago. Narendra Modi's government is hoping to avoid tariffs the Trump administration's already imposing on China. The president says today he plans to announce what he calls reciprocal tariffs, new tariffs to match the tax rates other countries charge on imports. Trump's pressing U.S. NATO allies to increase their defense spending. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth at the NATO summit in Brussels moments ago.
2% is a start, as President Trump has said, but it's not enough. Nor is 3%, nor is 4%, more like 5%.
Hegseth has ruled out Ukraine membership in NATO. With a single phone call, President Trump seems to be rewriting U.S. foreign policy with Russia. Jeremy Shapiro, research director of the European Council on Foreign Relations, says Trump signaled several messages in his talk yesterday with his counterpart Vladimir Putin about bilateral relations and the path ahead in Russia's nearly three-year-old war against Ukraine.
First, he's saying that it's not the U.S.'s responsibility to protect Ukraine and Europe. Second, I think he is sending the message that it's possible to change borders. And of course, he's been talking about changing borders in the U.S. with Greenland and Panama and even Canada.
That's Jeremy Shapiro speaking with NPR. This is NPR News. The full U.S. Senate has just confirmed Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Hamas says it will release more Israeli hostages in line with a ceasefire in Gaza. This comes after the Palestinian militant group threatened to delay the process and Israel threatened to renew fighting if hostages are not freed this Saturday. Honda and Nissan are dropping their more than $50 billion proposed merger. Had a deal gone through, the Japanese companies would have created one of the world's largest auto groups. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports talks broke down over differences on the structure of the new company.
Honda and Nissan signed an agreement in December to consider forming a joint holding company. Mitsubishi Motors was also to join in an attempt to make all three more competitive with Tesla and Chinese rivals. Nissan has been struggling since the arrest and ouster of its CEO Carlos Ghosn in 2018. Honda was not sure Nissan could recover, so it suggested making Nissan its subsidiary. Nissan's CEO, Makoto Uchida, told reporters that would not be acceptable. Nissan and Honda said in a statement they'll continue to collaborate on smart cars and electric vehicles. Both car makers now face the prospect of steep tariffs on exports to their main market, the U.S. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
U.S. stocks were trading higher this hour with the Dow up 113 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. The Trump administration's deferred resignation program for federal employees is going forward. A federal judge in Boston declined to block it last night. And the ruling came more than 2 weeks after the administration invited nearly the entire federal workforce to resign in exchange for pay and benefits through September. NPR's labor correspondent Andrea Hsu joins us now to talk about this. Hey, Andrea.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. So what was this lawsuit about exactly?
Yeah, it was brought by several labor unions who represent more than 800,000 federal workers. And they argued that the resignation offer was unlawful. They said the Office of Personnel Management, which sent out the original email titled Fork in the Road, they argued they had overstepped their authority in promising these pay and benefits to workers past mid-March when most agencies are set to run out of funding. And the unions also pointed to how this offer was rolled out, how the timeline was really short, the terms and conditions kept shifting. But in the end, none of that seemed to matter to the judge. District Judge George O'Toole, who was a Clinton appointee, ruled that the unions didn't have standing to bring the case in the first place.
So no standing, what did he mean by that?
Well, in his decision, O'Toole wrote that the unions are not directly impacted by the program. They're not federal employees themselves. Now, the unions had made the argument that they'd been inundated with calls from their members who are federal employees across many, many agencies, and it made it hard for them to do their normal union work, things like handling grievances and bargaining work. But that did not satisfy O'Toole, who also said the court didn't have subject matter jurisdiction. He said the complaints should have first been brought to the independent bodies within the government that settle labor disputes between civil servants and their agencies. Now, the unions have pointed out that Trump just this week removed two key members of those bodies, basically hobbling their ability to provide meaningful judicial review. But nevertheless, O'Toole denied the union's request for a temporary restraining order.
Okay, so these offers go forward. What happens next?
Yeah, the Office of Personnel Management sent emails out last night telling employees as of 7:20 p.m. the offer was closed, meaning they're not accepting more resignations, so presumably they start processing them. But an important point is that the judge did not address the legality of the program in his ruling, and unions have said this is a setback but not the end of the fight. They're exploring other options.
And do we know how many people actually took the offer?
Well, earlier this week, OPM told NPR that the tally had grown to more than 65,000. But this number might be high. The other day, there was a rally right next to the U.S. Capitol in support of federal workers. And I spoke to a number of union leaders there. Several told me that their members got the fork in the road email only to be told days later that you're not eligible. I talked to Rich Couture. He's an employee of the Social Security Administration, and he's also president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Council 215. He said his members all got the fork in the road email, but later were told you can't take it.
So most field office workers, hearing office workers, teleservice center workers, payment center workers, well, most of those positions are exempt.
And he told me he's not sure how many people may have accepted the offer before they were told they were being excluded. And I heard similar stories across other agencies as well. We do know the Trump administration has plans to dramatically downsize the government. We're hearing newer hires who are still on probation are already being cut. So there's a lot of fear right now and a lot of unknowns about what's ahead.
NPR's Andrea Hsu, thank you for your reporting.
You're welcome.
Earlier this week, President Trump pressured the King of Jordan to take in Palestinian refugees so that the U.S. could, quote, take over and redevelop Gaza. Yet just yesterday, he suggested Ukraine would have to cede territory to achieve peace with Russia. As NPR's Franco Ordonez reports, those are just a couple examples of Trump's foreign policy that have shaken the globe.
At his inaugural address, Trump declared the dawn of a new golden age for America.
From this day forward, our country will flourish and be respected again all over the world.
In the hours and days that followed, Trump temporarily froze foreign aid. He began steps to dismantle USAID and rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. The moves have raised questions of whether Trump's America First movement is moving from isolationism to imperialism. Bonnie Glaser, who directs the German Marshall Fund's Indo-Pacific program, says Trump is leaning into foreign policy in ways he didn't in his first term.
This is America First on steroids.
Trump was expected to pull the U.S. out of international institutions and use trade threats as leverage for negotiating. But what has shocked leaders around the world, she says, are the threats to take over Greenland, the Panama Canal, Gaza, and even Canada.
Trump wants to do everything he possibly can think of to strengthen the power of the United States, to bring investments to the U.S., jobs to the U.S., to control territory.
Trump never bought into the rules-based system that encouraged cooperation among like-minded allies. The idea that lifting up friends economically, socially, and democratically would also lift the U.S. Ivo Dalder, who served as a U.S. ambassador to NATO in the Obama administration, says Trump appears more emboldened to disrupt the system in ways he couldn't the first time.
He has a real clear sense that in this world and in this moment, the opportunity exists in ways that may not have existed in the first term or ever before to remake America's government and to remake America's role in the world.
On his flight to the Super Bowl, Trump signed a proclamation making official the renaming of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. I asked him how all these moves align with America First.
Because it makes us bigger, stronger, and better, and more protected.
And he says he and his team are better prepared this time.
It's more aggressive. It's better. Why? Because I think I've had a lot of experience. And in my first term, I was fighting everybody because they were very aggressive toward me.
In the process, Trump has done away with traditional roles of diplomacy. John Simon, who served as ambassador to the African Union in the Bush administration, points to Trump's handling of USAID, the government's agency to deliver humanitarian aid. He says the agency is one of the best ways to keep America safe from its enemies.
We're taking away this incredibly valuable arrow in our quiver to build support and respect and influence around the world.
Instead, Trump has appropriated methods used by authoritarian powers, such as China and Russia, says Lori Esposito Murray, a veteran in diplomatic circles now at the Council on Foreign Relations.
President Trump is not using traditional diplomatic tools, diplomacy, to achieve objectives. He is actually using the tools and the approach that our adversaries use in order to achieve their objectives within their sphere of influence.
She says Trump sees the Western Hemisphere as part of the U.S. sphere of influence, much like China views Taiwan and Russia, Ukraine.
I think you can fold the Panama Canal and Greenland into that strategic thinking.
So, in Trump's view, putting America first. Franco Ordonez, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Two of the country's youngest mayors, one a Democrat, the other a Republican, tell us what they need from Washington. That's next time on Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin. This is, of course, Kendrick Lamar's award-winning diss track, Not Like Us. And if it's stuck in your head, that's probably a good thing, because knowing it could help save a life. The American Heart Association says the song has the right tempo, 101 beats per minute, for administering CPR. So the next time you listen, maybe practice some CPR compressions while you're at it. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Getting out in nature and looking for birds has long been a popular pastime, mainly for people 40 and older. But as Carrie Sheridan with member station WUSF reports, young people are increasingly taking up bird watching.
About a dozen kids and some parents gather around David Schwab. He's a wildlife photographer, and he's sharing some tips for finding owls. First off, look up and around.
I'll just scan kind of this area and just look for that football. Just looking for that football in the tree. It looks just a little bit different, and that's how I find a lot of owls.
They set off on a hike in the late afternoon near a lake and some woods in Sarasota, Florida. They point their binoculars skyward. High in the air above the lake, two large birds start to spar with each other.
Oh, he's going after a duck or something.
What duck?
Everyone stops in their tracks. An eagle and an osprey are fighting over something.
Wow, that's a fish.
13-year-old Sadie Veltri explains what just happened.
The bald eagle and the osprey were fighting over the fish, and the osprey ended up dropping the fish so the bald eagle could have it.
Everyone is wide-eyed. Schwab says that behavior is actually pretty common.
An osprey will go and catch a fish, and the eagle, they are very lazy. They don't want to do the fishing. They will scare the osprey to drop the fish, and then they'll take the fish.
Dusk begins to fall. Time to keep walking. Nature groups like this are on the rise. Maya Thompson is in charge of youth programming at Cornell University's Lab of Ornithology in Ithaca, New York. She pulls out a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Survey.
So it's showing me that in 2016, the percentage of U.S. population of 16 and 17-year-olds who participated in wildlife watching away from home was 11%, and now it's up around 30%.
Helping bird-loving kids find their people was why Jim McGinnity, a science teacher in Tampa, started the Florida Young Birders Club a few years ago. He says the main difference between older birders and younger ones is how fast they learn.
I've been just floored by these, we're talking 12, 13-year-olds who, they know way more than I do.
And they're persistent. After almost 2 hours of searching, these kids are still walking in the woods of Sarasota, hoping to find an owl. They cross a little creek, and then, in a clearing, a flash of brown and white wings whisks by without a sound.
Barred owl. Did everyone see it fly?
No. I got out of the corner of my eye.
So we'll just try to be quiet a little bit. The barred owl definitely flew across. We'll go this way to see if we can locate it.
There it is, high in a tree. A hush falls on the crowd as everyone looks up, and the owl looks back at us with its dark, round eyes above a tiny yellow beak. Well, what do you think of that?
It's really cool. It's really cool.
After a few minutes, we see the owl's neck bulge. We hear it call to its mate. We hear another owl off in the distance. The young birders are happy. They found what they set out to see. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Sheridan in Sarasota.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. We don't know exactly how Doge, Elon Musk's entity focused on cutting the size of the federal government, is using artificial intelligence, but some say employing it at all within a government agency is cause for alarm. Kevin DeLeban is a public interest attorney who offered our co-host Steve Inskeep his perspective. He began by detailing a case he won against the state of Arkansas, which had denied some benefits to Medicaid recipients.
I had several disabled and elderly clients who were part of a Medicaid program that would provide in-home caregiving assistance that folks needed to live independently and stay out of nursing facilities. And these were folks with severe conditions, quadriplegia, advanced multiple sclerosis, cerebral palsy, things that don't get better. And suddenly, the state decided to cut their care drastically, by 50% in some cases, dropping people from, say, 8 hours a day of care to 4 or 5. And this meant incredible suffering. People were lying in their own waste. They were getting bed sores from not being turned. They were being shut in. And what we found out is that the state had implemented an algorithmic decision-making system to decide how much care people actually needed. And that choice was what was propelling the cuts.
Would you explain an algorithmic decision-making system? That just means there's a computer that's been given some parameters and it says this person gets this many hours of care.
Yes, exactly. And some of these systems are based on really advanced forms of statistical analysis, as was the case in Arkansas. Others of these systems are just kind of haphazardly thrown together.
What did you do about this?
So we launched multiple lawsuits that were successful in federal court and state court. We undertook a massive public education campaign to help the wider public understand why this was dangerous and harmful. We helped activate the community most affected by this, disabled folks, their allies, their families. And ultimately, we were able to win both in the courts and politically with the Arkansas State Legislature determining that this was too cruel even for Arkansas.
So what do you think about when you bring this past experience to the news of recent weeks as the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has been rummaging around in federal computer databases?
Well, I understand that most of the time when AI is being used for governmental purposes, it means that the public is likely to be harmed. I just haven't seen any instance where AI was implemented for governmental functions where that wasn't the case.
What do you mean?
So every time government uses AI, whether it's for public benefits administration, people get cut. Whether it's to reduce staff or increase efficiency, what ends up happening is services are harder to access, longer wait times, more frustration getting accurate information. So AI use in government generally hasn't worked well, particularly when there are no regulations or safeguards to ensure that this stuff isn't used for harmful ends. And in the case of DOGE, it's actively being weaponized to target President Trump's enemies, you know, diversity efforts, science, journalism, people who are transgender, civil rights.
I guess we should be clear that there's not a lot of transparency here. We're not entirely sure what DOGE is doing with various databases. And one of the stated purposes is to find waste or to find fraud. Could some kind of high-tech computer analysis of a database help to find those kinds of things?
No, not actually. So first of all, there are instances where governments have tried to use AI to detect fraud, for example, with unemployment benefits. Those were disastrous. A famous case in Michigan led to 40,000 people being falsely accused of having committed unemployment fraud. That was 93% of all people accused were falsely accused. And that drove them to financial desperation and in some cases even self-harm. So we know that when AI systems are used for something like fraud detection, it's not capable of doing that well. On top of that, Steve, there is a shell game here, which is that fraud has a specific legal definition, right? It's that you are intentionally trying to deceive the government to get benefits or a contract that you otherwise wouldn't. What's happening with DOGE is they are just going to program anything that the president disfavors to show up as fraud.
Kevin DeLeban is an attorney with Tectonic Justice, which advocates on AI issues. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
Photo booths have been around for 100 years, and they're still popular, especially when it comes to romance. NPR's Chloe Veltman recently visited San Francisco's new photo booth museum where young couples were enjoying the run-up to Valentine's Day.
There are many great places in the world to steal a kiss, at bus shelters and on front porches, under umbrellas and in the back row at the flicks. But sharing a smooch in a photo booth takes things to another level.
You get to go into like this tiny box together, and it's very personal. And
there's a curtain. Yeah. You don't feel judged. And it's really fun that I got to let loose and just be goofy.
Andrew Wills and Jade Pineda are first-timers at the Photo Booth Museum. As they wait for their strip to emerge from one of the museum's four vintage photo machines, they tell me they met 8 years ago in college.
There was a guys group and a girls group, and we kind of melded our freshman year, and then
we had a friendship from there that turned into a romance.
And let's take a look at these photos. You're having a nice smooch in some of them there.
Oh, just a couple.
Oh, adorable.
The pair say when they get home, they'll put the strip in a frame or on the fridge.
I could definitely see it being the Valentine's tradition.
Capturing romantic photo booth moments is already a tradition for other couples at the museum, like Syl Cole and Ashley Abaya.
We've done it in LA, we've done it in the city, we've done it like all around. So we've got a little bit of a collection going.
They met at church and have been getting close to each other in photo booths for 2.5 years.
I think they just capture cool memories.
So you can link certain strips to certain day trips or weekend trips or whatever, and it's kind of like a timeline.
Yeah.
For the many teens and 20-somethings packed into the museum's storefront space on this rainy Saturday afternoon, it's a rare chance to take a picture you can hold.
I love having the tangible memory of just doing something fun.
Kira Hernandez is here with boyfriend Brian Ruvalcaba.
The photo booths offer like the vintage feel, so it's just always fun to try to capture like the old ways that people used to do it.
When their photos slide out of the machine, they're not quite perfect.
Got one that looks kind of strange because we weren't ready.
No matter, that strip will still be part of the couple's growing collection.
Just keep it in my memory book.
They're planning to celebrate Valentine's Day itself in another traditional way, at a restaurant. Chloe Veltman, NPR News, San Francisco.
And love is all that I can give to you. Love.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
In all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day